Well, hello. You know, with a grocery store near everyone's front door, feeding ourselves is an easy proposition. But such was not always the case. In fact, many of our forebears had no grocery stores at all. And this leads us to ask, how did we eat before there were stores? Hello out there. You are tuned into the 548th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Pucallpa, Peru, who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page. We do have it easy when it comes to feeding ourselves. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Bill Graff on the boards. Hello, Bill.
Hello.
And also producers Carol Stafford, Parmley Taffin, Kelsey Olson, all together now.
Good morning.
Way to go, girls. Folks, when it comes to feeding ourselves, we do have it made, do we not? There are grocery stores everywhere you look, and from them we can get fresh seafood sushi, though thousands of miles away from the sea, and we can do it in the middle of the night. Always there. Grocery stores weren't all. And so we scratch our head and wonder what life was like, how we fed ourselves before there were stores, before there were grocery stores on almost every stores. And here to help us explore the question, we have Roger Welsh, the sage of Dannebrog, Nebraska, an author, a professor, and a storyteller from Dannebrog, the Cather's Kitchens, and also a former English and anthropology professor at the University of Nebraska. Hello, Roger. Welcome back.
Good morning, Michael. It's nice to be here.
Well, and here is Dannebrog, Nebraska, right? You're in Dannebrog today?
Well, I'm outside of Dannebrog. I can't stand all that traffic in Dannebrog, so I stay out here on the farm.
Do you have a traffic light yet?
No. Okay. No, we don't. You know, we used to have a four-way stop, but people got tired of sitting there waiting for three other cars to show up. So we're just happy with a stop sign here. There are no stop lights.
True to struggle to feed themselves. We sure do have it easy, do we not?
We have it easy, but I'm not sure it's always the best way to live. Easy,
that's what Cather's Kitchens.
Well, if you'd ever seen a photograph of me, Michael, you'd know that I consider myself an accomplished eater. I've devoted an awful lot of time and energy toward eating, and I consider it one of my hobbies. But in anthropology, you can hardly avoid it. And I started spending a lot of time with the Omaha Indians in particular in the beginning, and was interested that they were eating things that we didn't consider food, and some things that we might have considered food if we'd known about them, but I had never seen them before. And I thought, here are two cultures living side by side, closely integrated, and yet we're still eating differently. And so I got into the idea of wild foods, plants, and that the importance of food within a culture. And then I ran into a guy named Jay Anderson, who is a professor now at Utah State in Logan, and his specialty was the anthropology of food. And the two of us kind of teamed up and really went at it in a big way as the Living History Farm Movement developed, and people were more
and more. The Living History Farm Movement? What is that?
That's right. The more and more museums that are not just repositories for artifacts, but places where processes are shown, where the farming process that she used food to do that kind of thing, mm-hmm. and her use of food in her books. One of my former students came up, and she was a curator.
Do things like they showed children how butter was made.
That's right.
How wheat was harvested and
increasingly they show adults.
Yes, adults
may
exactly.
not know those things either. But we had to do a lot of research in what it was that people ate and how they prepared it and how they came to eat those things. And we worked at a number of different museums together in developing foodways programs. And it's a natural sort of fascination for me.
When you say foodways, what does that mean?
Well, it's pretty complex because it isn't simply what we eat. It's how we eat. It's written on the back of envelopes and on various containers and things that came out of that, because we don't just eat what we eat because it's good for us or because it tastes good or because it's convenient or because it's economical. We eat what we eat in large part because that's what we eat, and we make some cultural decisions or we ride the momentum of tradition and pretty much understand that what we eat is what ought to be eaten and what those other people eat, oh, good grief, how do they do that?
In Cather's Kitchens, you write, you quote a famous German saying, man isst, was man isst.
That's right.
What does
and
that mean?
The Beatles said it, too. You know that what you eat, you are.
Yes. And I guess in that respect, then, you can't really stop.
So my wife and I then went through all of these files and matched up recipes with the food mentions that appeared within Cather's books and did the book Cather's Kitchens.
Well, you know, we were talking about how much easier we have it today, but we're wondering if we have it any better. And, you know, you talk a little bit about...
People at Christmas time have a specific kind of food they eat. This, just a couple of days ago, Linda almost went into shock because it was the first time she could remember that she hadn't fixed their special kind of potato salad for the 4th of July, but she just couldn't get around to it, and it was like this huge gap in our lives because that potato salad
was 4th of July.
Parcel of the 4th of July, much more than fireworks for us.
Well, you know, in considering this program, I got to thinking about, you know, my food habits, and I got to thinking about whether or not I had ever eaten a meal that had not come, at least in part, from a store. And I thought back to being raised on my grandparents' farm near Belfry, Montana. It was probably one of the most self-sufficient farms in the world with respect to food. I mean, they pretty much grew everything we needed right there on the farm. And yet we still went to the store for sugar and flour and things like that. And in really thinking about it, I realized that the only time that I... Would you elaborate on that?
I've always thought that was a fascinating social device that Taffy, of course, was especially...
Amazon, when about 150 clicks from Pacalpa, Peru, where I was visiting the Shipibo Indians. And as part of being together, they prepared us this wonderful banquet. They baked some fish and some vegetables and some herbs and spices and in wrapped leaves, you know, and they put the leaves in the brought them out and opened them up. And, oh, my goodness, it was...
Let them have some private time, but with a certain amount of limits, after all, and you had to figure out some device for making sure that even though they were talking and chatting, that other than that, everything was kept on the up and up, and you would seem happy, because then the presumption could be that if they...
And yet our pilgrim and pioneer forebears pretty much had to do that all the time, because there really were no stores. So what on earth did they eat?
Yeah, I think that one of the real delights about wild foods, I did a book called Weed 'em and Reap, but one of the delights is to show children that they can pick something off of a tree, even if it's just a mulberry, and it's good, and they can eat it, and it's something they didn't buy in the store. And on one occasion, I was on a canoe trip with a bunch of Boy Scouts, and they had a special mess tent put up. It was a big expedition, and they had food that they were cooking that they brought along.
Sure.
But I spotted a patch of into trouble.
And it really speaks then to the degree to which those pioneer and pilgrim foods led to kind of the development of culture. You also tell the story about pilgrim...
All these kids turning their backs on the mess tent where the prepared meals were being put together. Instead, they wanted to eat this wild food because it was almost... I think there's an identity between children and wheeze, you know, the idea that it's actually something that isn't official, you know, and they get to do it. And I think that more and more people see food that way, that going camping, especially if you're, you know, you can't do this in a campground where there's not likely to be much in the way of wild food, but pilgrim food. And we've got my specialty, or the Loup River, we're right on the banks of the Middle Loup River. When we went out canoeing, there's enough food along the way that it's pretty easy to pick up plenty of good food and exciting food and interesting food.
And there were plenty of foods available then in that respect for the pilgrims and the pioneers who were settling this country. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're Talking about wild foods, I reckon, or foods that came before the stores that populate our land. And we're wondering how on earth people ate before there were stores. And we're talking with Roger Welsh, who is an anthropologist, an English professor, but above all, one of our nation's leading storytellers, the sage of Dannebrog, Nebraska, and the author of Cather's Kitchens. So when we get back, we're going to talk a little bit again about the kinds of foods that pilgrims and pioneers ate when there were no stores. Right back. You stay tuned. Hey, I have a question for you. Have you ever eaten a meal that did not come from a store? Out there. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about how we ate before there were foods, there were grocery stores to eat from. It's amazing, you know, to consider that a world in which there were no grocery stores. It's really hard for us to imagine, but such was the case not too many generations ago as people moved from the from Europe to the new continent, to the new world, and they landed on the East Coast. And what did they find? Well, it depends on where they landed, I guess. Roger, did they find food there?
Yeah, you said something that wasn't quite accurate when we finished off that last segment, Michael, and that the pioneers had plenty of food when they came here. They not only didn't have a lot of food, they didn't know what was food.
Yeah, there you go.
And often when they found out what it was, they weren't all that fond of it. When the pilgrims came, they were used to things like rye and barley and mm-hmm. wheat. Well, that didn't grow very well out on Cape Cod, so they had to adjust to an entirely new grain, maize, and they didn't like it very much. They didn't have so much trouble with things like pumpkins and squash because there was nothing they could compare it to. They hadn't eaten anything like that before, so they couldn't say, well, this sure isn't as good as fill-in-the-blank.
We need to schedule a bone. We need to perform a urinary VNA. After you hear your child has cancer, chances are you don't hear anything else. CureSearch.org connects you to the most comprehensive research and advice on childhood cancer and to other families who know exactly what you're going through. CureSearch.org. You're not as alone as you feel. Brought to you by CureSearch and the Ad Council.
No cods. They had to settle for catfish, right?
And carp very often. A woman might walk 6-7 miles to a creek once or twice a year just to catch enough carp so that she could taste that again. There weren't the kind of grains that they were used to. They weren't cooking in the same kinds of stoves. They weren't cooking in the stone stoves. There's no stones out here, no brick, because there's no fuel to fire brick. So they were cooking on cast iron, and they were cooking with cow chips for fuel instead of the kind of clean wood that they were used to in Scandinavia.
Let's talk about the kitchens for just a moment. Of course, no electricity, no gas, no running water. How did they manage?
It was not an easy transition, and I think one of the things we forget is how many people failed. The men out here were happy. You know, they were used to farming plots of maybe 6 or 7 acres in Germany or Norway.
Thousands of acres, right?
And there it was all roots and rocks. And then they came here, and as one old-timer wrote in his journal, you could put a plow in the ground and go straight west without ever stopping for a root or a rock. So to them, this was heaven. But to women, the suicide rate was extremely high. The isolation was terrible.
And caring mother. How wise? With what we know today about vitamins, minerals, and antioxidants, Mom's Wisdom continues to increase in its value. You simply couldn't do better than eating 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. And why not? Don't you want to think smarter? Play harder? You will, you know. Your energy level will increase, and you'll just feel stronger, more vital. So make your mom proud. Next time you're at the market, select fresh fruits and vegetables grown right here in California. From baby carrots and red ripe tomatoes to crisp apples, succulent strawberries, and so much more. Be wise. Live well. Eat your 5-serve California Fresh. Learn more on the web at 5aday.com. This message is brought to you by Western Growers Association and its members representing the fresh produce industry of California and Arizona.
Indian food, and they didn't want somebody to come in and find that they were eating things like cattails or ground nuts or milkweed. And so while they even wrote in their journals that it was good food when they ate it, it was just low status, and they just couldn't bring themselves to doing that.
So I've often wondered about that, too. To me, in looking back at and I was raised in Montana, so I have a little bit of experience with the culture of the Plains Indians, and to me, it seemed like they led quite a, I don't know, romantic life, you know, following the buffalo herds. But there was always, it seemed to be relatively good meat on the hoof, as fresh as you could get it, you know. Periods of times when they had to go without, but by and large, they had a lot of meat. But it wasn't just meat. They had a lot of wild foods that the women from the ground. They had a fairly good diet that they were living on and kind of living as well.
And they knew everything that was edible. They knew at what point it was ready to be harvested. Yep. They knew where to find it. It's not as if an Indian woman would go out looking for her food, for her family's food, and just flail around. She had kind of a grocery store all around her, and she knew where the best arrowheads. Potatoes River, because the ground wild turnips grew all along here, and they knew where to find these things. So it's not as if they really had to work very hard or very long to put together plenty of food for their families.
Well, the difference, though, was that the Indians were transitory. I mean, they were here today and gone tomorrow, and were following. Essentially, they followed the food.
Well, that's true of the kinds of native groups that you're talking about up in Montana. Mm-hmm. The Crow, the where we live, and they were farmers. They grew corn. They went out twice a year hunting buffalo, as did the Omaha, but they had permanent cities. They had gardens. They grew corn, squash, lots of different varieties of corn that are now being regenerated from seeds rescued from sacred bundles. Squash, potatoes. They had quite a few crops that they grew too, and they were pretty much farmers. They were bean farmers.
When you say sacred bundles, what does that mean?
Well, there were various clans and groups, subgroups, that had bundles of sacred items that were sacred to them.
Was it always so?
And very often within those bundles and were appropriately seeds from plants, because plants were, sure. Mother Corn was one of the major deities for the Pawnee, for example. So it wouldn't be surprising to have some kernels or even a whole ear of corn within a sacred bundle, that each house had a sacred bundle hanging at an important place on the east side of the lodge. And it was occasionally opened, and it was used in different ceremonies. Well, these sacred bundles have been preserved in many families and in many museums, and there are people now who are taking few of these precious kernels from the sacred bundles and regenerating the kinds of crops that were
out of the prairie. My gosh, what a tough life. And yet, that we have it so easy, are we missing something by having to struggle a little bit? Roger Welsh.
This is the first time the Pawnee have owned land in Nebraska in 133 years. It's our place right here. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they are going to be doing here is growing plots of this corn.
And they let you live on it still.
Yep, they're letting us live on it, but we went from landowners to homeless waifs living on Indian land a couple of months ago. And it feels pretty good, as a matter of fact.
Interesting. So in doing so, you're looking to preserve some of those foodways that the Indians had so many years ago.
That's right, and as a matter of fact, it's really beginning to be pretty exciting. We thought, I've been growing things here for 30 years because of my interest in wild food, so I had calamus and wild onions. And
what about us city people? I mean, we do have it so easy. Is it all that good?
Well, those of us here in the country have it the same way. We can, as you say, run in the grocery store and buy foods from all over the world. fresh, easy.
Fresh sushi in the middle of Dannebrog, Nebraska, probably.
Yeah. Maybe not sushi yet, but
it's coming to a corner near you, right?
My buffalo herd. And it seemed to me that maybe along with the land, we ought to get the Pawnee back in the buffalo business. So now we have five buffalo, too. They're not here on our place, but the Pawnee are starting their buffalo. And especially in the English language, where we have one word for the animals and then another word for the meat that comes from those animals, we tend to forget the gratitude that we owe other creatures for dying to make our lives,
at least in part, from some store along the way. If you have eaten such a meal, give us a ring and tell us about it. Kind of curious. The only one I can think of ever eating was one I had way down in the headwaters of the Amazon, and all the rest of them, at least in part, came from a store. 831-479-1080 and 800-624-2665. Welcome back out there. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. And we've got none other than Roger Welsh with us today, who is the sage of Dannebrog, Nebraska. And we've got you. Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. I think I have Roger. Roger, are you there?
Yep, I'm here. They're driving up to a drive-in window and having them hand you something when you hand them the money.
And thus, the joy of gardening, right? You're actually doing something to feed yourself. And
enough other problems. So, you know, I've always laughed when people talked about it being the simple life, because actually our life is the simple life, because, I have computer troubles, but I haven't the foggiest notion what's going on inside. There could be chipmunks running it, as far as I know.
Yeah.
But those people, as you say, they had to scrounge up all their own food. They had to make their own entertainment. They had to deliver their own children. They had to shoe their own horses. They had to tell their own weather and do everything.
It's hard to imagine, you know, having your next door neighbor out of sight for a month at a time. It's hard to imagine what those homesteaders went through and the terrible loneliness that they went through.
I remember one time being really stunned at the idea of that. You know, I'd heard about it and thought about it and all of that, but it's always the story. The
mission where you can enjoy it and hold that tomato up and say, I grew this.
Yeah, but you say, God and I did this.
God and I did this.
Partnership. It'd be hard at getting their house built and getting things started, and then winter hit. And the next spring, there was a strange sound after the thaw, and it was a neighbor's wagon coming over. The woman of this house ran out of their sod house and toward the wagon. The woman on the wagon jumped off the wagon and came to her, and they embraced. They had never met each other before, but it was the first woman either one of them had seen in 4 or 5 months. It's just impossible to imagine. You know, I don't know how many new faces I will see today. You know, I drove up to town to get the mail, and I saw some people in their cars, and I turn on television, and there's this concert going on around the world, and I see tens of thousands of people, and I see riots in China and all of that. So I don't even know how many new faces I see every day.
Millions.
But to go for months and months and months without ever seeing another face.
Yeah, an amazing life. Let's go that I love to talk about. So, folks, thank you for tuning in. Tune in next week for more What's Eating What. Thank you. How did they manage their food in those situations? I mean, how did they cook? How did they store? How did they refrigerate? How on earth did they get by with it? I mean, we're so nervous, you know, when our potato salad goes for 2 days.
I think maybe they had stronger stomachs than we do, because one of the recipes I always loved, when I was doing some research for one of my books, I found an old newspaper, and on the front page the editor said, a secret way to keep skippers out of your pork during the winter. Skipper
Day, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.barn
or buried in the oats.
Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.
How did pioneers figure out a way to keep skippers out of their pork in the spring? And I thumbed through the pages till I got back to where his solution was, and it was, eat it in the winter.
which of course is you eat it before it gets warm out.
That's right. You eat it before they come along, you'll be just fine.
And they did not dry it or jerk it like Indians did, simply because it was a low class thing to do, to have jerked beef.
And isn't that amazing? Now, here was something that they considered low class that they would have never done, and now if you buy jerky
you pay a fortune for it.
Very expensive sort of food. But that sort of cycle, it seems to me, is one of the fascinating pieces of the anthropology of food, is that those things which are strange and that we may even have an aversion for tend to go full cycle and become an icon of what it is that we are. So that Indians, to them now, the ultimate ethnic food is fry bread. You don't go to a powwow or any sort of
gathering. Tell people what fry bread is.
Well, it's a baking powder dough that is deep fat fried. And it's absolutely delicious. I love the stuff. But if you think about it, baking powder, where would the Indians have gotten baking powder? And to deep fat fry something, you've got to have iron utensils.
Right, right.
They got this from the military. It's a U.S. military food because soldiers obviously couldn't carry bake ovens with them, and they couldn't keep yeast. So this was the kind of bread that they generally prepared when they were out on a campaign. And so now the icon of Indian food, of Indian ethnicity, is a food that they borrowed from the U.S. military. And we, of course, have pretty much gone the other way around. Those foods that the pilgrims found really distasteful because they were Indian foods, or the pioneers, are what we consider our icons at Thanksgiving. The turkey, sweet corn, that some Europeans still call pig food. They just can't imagine us eating sweet corn. Sweet potatoes. All of these things that were native at one time, very strange, absolutely alien, have now become the very symbol of what we are.
Well, how do you define that transition? What made us take the leap from one side of the position to the other?
I can't imagine. It seems to me that would be the last thing to happen. Wouldn't we instead hang to what it is that represented our past?
To some degree,
that's still true. You know, you're still at Christmas time, and it's interesting to me that Thanksgiving is our real national holiday when everybody sits down and eats the same meal. And at Christmas, at least around here, it tends to be an expression of the old ethnicity, so that very often the Swedes eat lutefisk the one time of the year. It's their sort of witnessing of their past by eating something that they really hate.
and you know, we're talking about preserving foods without kitchens or without refrigeration. And I guess lutefisk is a prime example of that, is it not?
Yep, soaked in lye, then dried, and as one old timer told me, it was supposed to be leaned up on the outside wall of the grocery store so the dogs could add their special sort of flavoring to it too. But that was also one pioneer when I was asking him about cooking with cow chips, because there's no fuel out here on the plant.
Right, right.
There were no trees, and so they used dry cow chips. And he said, you really shouldn't feel sorry for us, though, using cow chips, because that way we didn't have to use salt and pepper.
It's hard to imagine, though, that people cooked with cow chips. What kind of ovens did they have that used cow chips?
Well, by the time they got out here to the plains, they had iron cook stoves,
okay.
And they started off very small, what we would call a laundry stove now, and worked their way up to the wonderfully elegant cook stoves. I have one down in my cabin that's very beautiful.
And they were extraordinarily beautiful. They had warming ovens, and they had this, and they had that. And
reservoirs for warm water, and they're really good. And we've even done a turkey in ours, and it does a very nice job. Now, it makes a cabin kind of hot if you do it during the warm weather, but during the winter, almost adds to the warmth of the cabin, of course. And during the summers, around here at least, many homes had summer kitchens. We have one here where we do cooking outside, away from the house.
Kind of like barbecues, right?
Yeah, Bambuck, that's right. Although they didn't do much cooking outside. After spending 14 or 15 hours outside in the fields, the last thing they wanted to do was sit around on a patio and eat. They wanted to be inside where it was dark and cool and crowded.
Okay, folks, right back. This is the Food Chain. Do stay tuned. We're with Roger Wells.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
We do have it easy when it comes to feeding ourselves, do we not? We can have fresh seafood sushi in the middle of the night, in the middle of the country, thousands of miles away from the sea. And so we scratch our head and wonder what life was like, how we fed ourselves before there were stores, before there were grocery stores on almost every street corner in the land. And here to help us explore the question, we have Roger Wells, the sage of Dannebrog, Nebraska, an author, a professor, and a storyteller from Dannebrog, Nebraska. Roger, in thinking about how easy we have it, it's truly amazing. You know, when you think about what the pioneers and the pilgrims went through to struggle to feed themselves, we sure do have it easy, do we not?
Well, we have it easy, but I'm not sure it's always the best way to live. Easy,
that's what I scratch my head about too. You know, you wrote a story in Cather's Kitchen. So tell us a little bit about Cather's Kitchens, will you?
Willa Cather is a Nebraska author and probably our most prominent citizen around the world. And in her prairie novels that she wrote about life in Nebraska, I had noticed that she used food very effectively as a literary device to delineate ethnicity and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I had written a paper about her use of food in her books. One of my former students came up, and she was a curator at the Cather Museum at that time. She said, "Do you know that we have Cather's mother's recipe file and her the recipe books and all of the recipes written on the back of envelopes and on various containers and things that Cather grew up with?" Cather wasn't a cook, but obviously she grew up in these families in small Nebraska towns and had eaten all of these foods, and here were the very recipes that I had written about in my paper. So my wife and I then went through all of these files and matched up the Cather family recipes with the food mentions that appeared within Cather's books and did the book Cather's Kitchens.
Well, you know, we were talking about how much easier we have it today, but we're wondering if we have it any better. And, you know, you talk a little bit about taffy and how one of the pioneer candies, one of the favorite things to do was to make candy. And that was, and you talked about there was something besides just eating the candy, but making the candy. And you talked a little bit about how a young couple could really get together by making taffy. Would you elaborate on that?
I've always thought that was a fascinating social device. That taffy, of course, was a special treat because it was a candy and so forth. But the advantage of it was that if you had a young man visiting your daughter and they wanted to have some private time, of course, and you might want to let them have some private time, but with a certain amount of limits after all, and you had to figure out some device for making sure that even though they were talking and chatting, that other than that everything was kept on the up and up, and you would simply have them make a batch of taffy, because then the presumption could be that if they weren't busy stirring the taffy or eating the taffy, they would be pulling the taffy, which of course is what makes taffy what it is, and their hands would be busy and sticky, and there wasn't any way they were going to get into trouble.
And it really speaks then to the degree to which those pioneer and pilgrim foods led to kind of the development of culture. You also tell the story about pilgrim football. Would you fire away on that one for us?
I worked at the Plymouth Plantation Museum with Jay Anderson in developing their foodways program there to reconstruct pilgrim food. And my specialty was fermentation. I had a diploma in wine and brewing chemistry, so the pilgrims drank enormous quantities of beer, and it was my task to develop the pilgrim beer.
And they drank enormous quantities of beer. Why?
Well, for a lot of different reasons. The wheat didn't grow very well on the sands of Cape Cod, so they called their beer their liquid bread. And, of course, they used hops. They didn't have hops. They used nettles primarily as the bitter agent in the beer. They got vitamin C from that. There was the yeast with a B1 complex, and so it was a very nutritious food. They drank the beer very young, about a week, and it had a lot of yeast in it, so it was very nutritious.
A lot of food in there.
Heavy, almost like a sweeter Guinness is what it was like. So they drank a lot of beer. But one of the things I've always loved about the Thanksgiving, the real Thanksgiving, is that they drank enormous quantities of beer, and their principal import, which was gin. Then after they had their big Thanksgiving meal, they all watched the boys kick around a ball and play football out in the town square on that Thanksgiving. So for those families that where the old man sits out there in his big lounging chair, drinks a few beers, maybe a gin martini, and then after the meal watches a football game on television, that is precisely the traditional thing to do to celebrate the real Thanksgiving.
Gosh. Okay, folks, Food Chain, when we come back, we're going to conclude with Roger Welsh, who has more stories than you can contain in the great state of Nebraska. But they're all there, and this is the Food Chain. I am Michael Olson, your host for the hour. When we get back, we want to ask Roger what we who have it so easy can take from the foodways of those who had it so tough to maybe add a little bit to our lives. We will be right back. This is the Food Chain. Do stay tuned. Well, folks, we do have it easy when it comes to food. There's a grocery store on every corner of the land, it seems. Can't go very far without seeing one, and so feeding ourselves is pretty easy, but it wasn't always so. For our forebears, the pilgrims and the pioneers who settled this country, it was tough times finding the food and figuring out what to do with it. Nothing to cook your bread, bake your bread with, but cow chips in an oven out of the prairie. My gosh, what a tough life. And yet, that we have it so easy, are we missing something by having to struggle a little bit? Roger Welsh, you've been looking at the food of our pilgrims and our pioneer forebears for a long time, and you've been living that life out there in the prairies of Dannebrog, Nebraska. What about us city people? I mean, we do have it so easy. Is it all that good?
Well, those of us here in the country have it the same way. We can, as you say, run in the grocery store and buy foods from all over the world. Fresh, easy.
Fresh sushi in the middle of Dannebrog, yep. Nebraska, probably.
Yep. Maybe not sushi yet, but
it's coming to a corner near you, right?
Still considered bait out here. But, we can get fresh food so easily, and I think especially in the English language, where we have one word for the animals and then another word for the meat that comes from those animals, we tend to forget the gratitude that we owe other creatures for dying to make our lives possible. And there was a time when giving thanks for daily bread really did mean something, because daily bread was not all that certain. And I think one of the things that we kind of forget with the ease of acquiring our foodstuffs today is how lucky we are, especially in America, where we are so incredibly rich. That we really, some people, of course, still have to struggle to get together food, but most of us are not going to starve in our lifetimes, and that's pretty remarkable in this world.
And so there's really something that we can take from the struggles of our forebears, and that is the fact that it wasn't always easy, and it may not always be so easy in the future. So even though we have it easy now, perhaps it's something that we should look at the ways of the food ways of our forebears and see.
And there is an enormous amount of satisfaction, after all. Even if it was just picking that mulberry and eating it, there's some satisfaction in knowing that just with your own agency, you have managed to generate something by the way of food. And here in our house, we have chives growing in pots outside and wild onions and that kind of thing. And it's not much, maybe, to chop up some chives into cottage cheese, but it's my contribution to the food chain and my part in preparing the food. And I think there is a satisfaction that comes from that that you don't get just by going to the grocery store and buying something prepared or driving up to a drive-in window and having them hand you something when you hand them the money.
And thus the joy of gardening, right? You're actually doing something to feed yourself and enjoying the entire process and becoming involved in perhaps the ways of our forebears too, the struggle to get things past all of the bugs and past the bad weather and past everything to fruition where you can enjoy it and hold that tomato up and say, I grew this.
Yeah, but you say, God and I did this.
God and I did this.
Partnership.
Well, Roger Welsh, it's always a pleasure to be with you and to talk with you and to hear your stories. Love to talk with you again sometime down the future. Maybe we can talk about tractors, which is a subject that you know a lot about and a subject that I love to talk about. So, folks, thank you for tuning in. Tune in next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on the Food Chain. Thank you.
Been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.